This is Brian Forster, and welcome to the Active Investor Podcast, our monthly look at what's happening across asset management and how investment leaders at our firm are thinking about markets and opportunities today, as well as strategies that can help investors navigate different challenges. We took a bit of a hiatus on this podcast series with the move we had at our firm into a new building here now at 30 Hudson Street and the build out of our new podcast studio. And so we're back and ready to resume. And in today's edition, we welcome back Darnell Aziz to talk about equities and specifically high quality equities. Darnell is the head of our value equities capability at Lord Abbett, which has two distinct approaches, one that is focused on dividends and one focused on more traditional or value style box strategies. He's a partner at our firm and has been with Lord Abbett for the better part of two decades. So Darnell, welcome.
Thank you, Brian.
So as we're recording this, I should note that it's April 9th, 2025. And so we are in the midst of a sudden, almost bear market, and it's one that's been sparked by a big fiscal shock, namely tariffs and trade wars. And so as a result, equities have seen some sharp declines, big swings up and down over the past couple of weeks, particularly in the past 7 days since the tariffs were announced. And a lot of people are starting to worry about things like a recession, even more volatility, and overall repricing of risk and earnings and economic growth. Before we get into all that fun stuff, though, one thing we didn't get into last time that we talked on this podcast was just a little bit about your background. So maybe you could talk about how you got into investing in the first place, and then how you ended up becoming a value investor here at Lord Abbett.
Sure, happy to do that. Thank you, Brian, and hello, everybody. So I had a little bit of a non-traditional route into my current role. First, probably don't have the typical Wall Street background. I was an inner city kid, grew up in the Bronx, through college, played football in college, went to Lafayette, and then started my career here at Lord Abbett over 20 years ago on the sales desk, actually in a distribution role. So I started, in sales, did that for 2 years. Then moved into institutional sales, selling our products to pension funds, Taft Hartleys, et cetera. And in those 2 years, I worked through our CFA or worked through the CFA curriculum, passing levels one and level two. I didn't have a grand scheme to become an investor. It was simply I wanted to be a more differentiated salesperson. I was younger than a lot of my peers and figured I would relate to clients from a more technical standpoint. But when I passed the first two levels, I ultimately said, okay, well, if it doesn't work out, or I thought maybe I'd try to pivot into an investment role, thinking if it doesn't work out in investments, I can get back into distribution. Whereas if I went too many years into distribution, it'd be difficult to reverse into investments. Additionally, I just always had a pretty large interest in learning a lot of things and a pretty curious mind. In general, and you really had an opportunity to push further into that aspect of myself in investment. So got the opportunity in late 2006, early 2007 to work as a member of our value team at that point. I was a small cap analyst, a small cap generalist, so looking at smaller companies across industries. Got a really good technical learning and understanding how to understand businesses, balance sheets, income statements, and really sort of the nitty-gritty analytical work that any person that gets into investment would go through. Did that for a number of years, actually left the firm for about a year and a half, came back and rejoined the firm as a fixed income portfolio manager, working as a PM on our multi-asset strategy bond debenture, as well as a PM on our convertible strategy for a few years. And then was asked to come back to the equity department to work as a portfolio manager, leading our income strategies affiliated in dividend growth, and then eventually to head up our entire value franchise, as you mentioned earlier, Brian. So I've had a lot of diverse experience, experience in sectors as well as asset classes, and I think that's sort of well rounded me out in terms of. Being an investor, a value investor, I think ultimately everybody's a value investor. Ultimately, everybody wants to own attractive companies or quality companies that attract valuations, and how you go about that may vary. But ultimately, that's what any investor's trying to do, right? You're trying to provide good risk-adjusted returns, buy good businesses at attractive prices.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you don't hear a lot of equity PMs that were at one point were fixed income PMs. That's got to give you kind of a a unique perspective on the capital markets.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think just understanding how different investors see the world, understanding how people think about risk, right? In particular, right? Fixed income managers are very concerned about getting paid back. Mm-hmm. Equity managers a lot of times are thinking about the optimistic scenario in terms of upside, things like that, and trying to triangulate those views to understanding both markets and individual investments is very, very important. And ultimately, you're just trying to see things a little bit differently than maybe consensus or the market to drive out performance. So I do lean into all those relationships and that experience that I've had throughout my career.
Interesting. Well, I would imagine that's giving you some assistance right now, but maybe not. We're in the midst of some market chaos right now, and maybe we kind of go there. And I'll just reiterate that we're recording this on April 9th. We're going to try and make some sense out of it, but this might get outdated in a couple of hours or a couple of days. But I would like to get your sense of how you're thinking about this very new environment that we've entered over the past week, really, particularly with tariff, trade wars, the fears of triggering a recession. How are you and your team feeling about equities right now, along with the broader earnings and economic environment, given everything that's going on?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, as you mentioned, it changes by the day, by the hour, and by the minute almost. So, and we're adjusting our views accordingly. I think the best thing to do is maybe take a step back and think about sort of the path and how we got here. So, obviously the market priced in a lot of positivity post-election. I think there was a few reasons for that. Obviously, there was concern that the election would be disputed. It certainly wasn't. It was a resounding victory. And then there was the assumption that it was a very, very pro-business administration that was coming in. I think a bunch of people were quoted as saying this is the most pro-business government that we had seen in our lifetime. And you saw risk assets respond to that. So markets were very buoyant post-election. So you had a lot of positivity and optimism built into the equity markets. You seen positioning that was very, very extreme. Sentiment was very, very positive and extreme coming into this year. And what happened was, what I thought happened in 1Q was a little bit of an unwinding of some of those extremes. And a lot of that really was focused on sort of the big Mag 7 names. And so 1Q, though the market was down around 5%, the equal weighted S&P was essentially flat. So it was, I felt like that was more of a positioning unwind as opposed to people more concerned about recession. Oil was the top performing sector in 1Q, and you don't tend to see energy, not oil, but energy. You don't tend to see energy stocks outperform if people are worrying about a recession.
Right.
But it was underowned, and I think it was more of a positioning unwind. So if you fast forward to post-Liberation Day, I think things have changed rather dramatically. And what you've seen now is sort of the reverse, where I think now the market and many strategists are pricing in recession odds much higher than it had been previously. So what we've seen is now, very importantly, spreads starting to widen out on the fixed income side. You're starting to see more economically sensitive areas, banks, energy, oil prices begin to drop pretty rapidly. You see tremendous volatility in the equity market. More economically sensitive areas begin to drop as the market is really grappling with the uncertainty that's coming out of the administration and the global sort of tit for tat that we're seeing right now. Markets don't like uncertainty, and we're trying to navigate it through like everybody else. I think ultimately what we're trying to do is find high quality companies trading at attractive valuations. That tends to be our strategy in all environments. I think this is a great opportunity to maybe upgrade our portfolios. When we sit down as a team, we think about companies that, we have a watch list, obviously, of names that we look at, and we say, well, if we were worried about valuation for X, Y, and Z, now is an opportunity to do that. It's an opportunity to upgrade your portfolio. We have to, as investors, take a 6-9 1-year outlook on things. And in fact, we underwrite our investments over a 3-year time period. So, you know, I think that's what we're trying to do. I think that's what most people are trying to do. If you're paying attention, take advantage of the volatility, lean into it, and come out on the other side in a better situation than you came in on. You know, the other thing, if you take a step back and just look at historically, when you have these jumps in the VIX over 40 and over 50, the forward returns in equity markets are quite attractive. And, you know, this is not my first crisis. It's not the team first crisis. It sort of started right at the beginning of the financial crisis. You know, we've dealt with COVID, obviously. People forget about, we were talking earlier, people forget about SIVB, you know, the banking crisis, the you know, had the yen carry trade last year. I mean, this is a little bit different. But at the end of the day, you know, our job is to navigate through this and take advantage of volatility.
Yeah, it almost feels like we're having a once in a century crisis every 2 years.
It does seem that way.
So, all right, thanks for that. That's it's definitely a fluid situation, and a lot to pay attention to. You mentioned the word high quality. So thinking about the importance of things like profitability, return on capital, free cash flow, you know, strong balance sheets, growing dividends, all signals of quality. And it seems like that word quality has become really important since the inflation surge of 22 and 23. Not that it wasn't important before then, but certainly with the normalization of rates, it's a very different world than, say, the post-GFC environment of, you know, zero interest rates, when quality didn't seem to be as important. Can you talk a little bit about just the overall evolution of value investing in the last few decades and sort of like where that quality component fits in?
Sure. Yeah, happy to chat about it. I think it's an important question, particularly right now. You know, we went through that period of free money post GFC up through COVID, and then we got hit with an inflationary scare. And then, you know, obviously the Fed responded by raising rates. You know, to sort of answer your question, I don't think we're going back to this free money era anytime soon. If you look at the deficit, if you look at tariffs, which are inflationary, and as we have this conversation right now, I think the scariest part is that, you know, rates are going higher with equity markets going lower. I don't know if that'll last, but that's certainly the scenario we're in right now. I think the Federal Reserve will probably react with interest rates cuts, but I don't think that the aggressive liquidity injections are here to stay. So what does that mean, or coming back? So what does that ultimately mean? We think in a world where cash is or money is no longer free, the market is going to be more discriminating in terms of what it rewards, and so the market's going to be more discriminating in terms of coalescing around quality names. You know, it's not good enough to have a great idea that's going to make money, you know, sometime in the future. You know, where risk-free assets were zero, that was okay. That was an option. But right now, that's no longer the case. So we think that's important. We focus on quality. We want companies that can navigate in an uncertain environment. We want companies that can self-fund. We want companies with strong balance sheets. We want companies that can thrive, take market share in a volatile environment. And if you are, you know, kind of going to your question about the evolution of value investing, I'll tie it back to that. You know, we tend to look at, from a valuation standpoint, we look at normalized free cash flow yield as our main valuation metric. And the world that has evolved to focus on more intangible assets as opposed to tangible assets in the modern economy, the idea to look at price to book to value companies in the modern economy, I think you miss a lot. And value investors that haven't made that adjustment to look at free cash flow and are still looking at book value, you're basically you know, running valuation analysis for an economy that was in the 60s and 70s. It's ironic that because a lot of what we're doing on a tariff standpoint is sort of trying to bring back those old manufacturing jobs, which are gone. But we like companies that generate a ton of free cash flow. We normalize the free cash flow over a 3-year time period, and we focus a lot on quality. So the combination of quality, valuation, and stability allows us to self-select a portfolio of good companies trading at attractive valuations, and the right valuation metric we think is normalized free cash flow yield.
Yeah, because I mean, book value has lost a lot of its value, right? Because it only captures tangible assets, so plant, property, and equipment. So like you were saying, back in the 60s and 70s, it made probably a lot more sense to look at price to book than today, when we're in a very asset-light economy. A lot of assets are no longer captured in book value. It's intangibles. And so, I mean, you're really putting a big priority on free cash flow yield versus, say, price to earnings, price to book. That whole normalization component, or, you know, kind of maybe walk us through just how you think about just that valuation metric and how that helps you identify great companies at good prices.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we normalize the free cash flow estimate based on, you know, markets run in cycles, right? And so you can have ups and downs. And so we think when you look out and normalize free cash flow yield, you avoid buying, you know, companies at cyclical tops, and you can lean into companies at cyclical bottoms, right? Mm-hmm. You avoid value traps is essentially what we're trying to do, yep. Which is something that has destroyed value managers since there have been value managers around. You know, a lot of people may ask, you know, why not pay attention to earnings? And we do pay attention to earnings, and we just the same way we pay attention to book value when it comes to certain financials, et cetera. You know, where it's relevant. But, you know, the problem with earnings is earnings can be manipulated by accounting gimmicks. And, you know, ultimately, it's very, very difficult or impossible to manipulate cash flow unless you're really, really trying. So that really gives you a better underlying view of what the underlying business is doing and producing. And so we lean into that quite a bit.
Okay. You know, let's shift gears a little bit here and talk a little bit about dividend investing. Which I know your team manages two strategies focused on dividends. One is focused in particular on the growth of dividends, really companies that can consistently grow them even during the worst of times. So what's interesting here is companies like that, that can grow year after year their dividend, you would argue that there probably have to be sort of high quality companies to be able to do that. They also don't tend to be the highest yielding ones though, right? And so it's not necessarily a strategy where you'd be only like clipping a coupon and you know, almost replacing fixed income, but it's more like a signal of quality, I think. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about just sort of like how you think about a strategy like that and sort of like what it is, or what value that serves for investors, especially at a time like this.
Yeah, absolutely. This is absolutely a great time for, we think, dividend growth investing in general. So I'll take a step back and just talk about the genesis of the product. Ultimately, what we noticed was that companies that have increased their dividends for a number of years provide what I mentioned earlier, what everyone's looking for from an investment standpoint, which is great risk-adjusted returns. So better returns, less volatility, which is ultimately what you want in any investment. So we built a product around that, dividend growers. And so essentially what we're doing is fishing in a higher quality pool, you know, to your point, Brian. You know, companies, and usually we tend to look at it around 10 years of dividend growth history. We have some flexibility, a lot of flexibility around that. But if you've been able to grow your dividend for a number of years, probably indicates that you've, one, you've gone through a few market cycles. Two, you have a strong enough balance sheet to give your investors a raise year after year. Three, you probably have a management team and a board of directors that understands that returning money to shareholders is very important. So what does that do? It probably prevents them from making humongous bets that may hurt the financial position of the company. And to your point about high yielders, you know, we like yield, current yield as much as anybody else, but you tend to have two flavors of high current yield, high current dividend yield stocks. One, you have sort of your low beta, high yielding names, which you may get in pharma or telecom. Nothing wrong with those names. We own a few of those. We like good fundamental companies and good fundamental stories. But you know, yield's important, just like valuation is. But ultimately, if a stock's just going to go sideways and give you a big chunky yield, that's okay. But you can also just go in cash and get no volatility and get the same amount of yield. The other thing, which is much much worse, is that, you know, again, people forget that, you know, yield moves inverse to price. So if a company has kept their dividend flat and the stock keeps dropping and dropping and dropping, the yield will go up. Yeah, so it's great if you've got a 9% dividend yield, but if that 9% yield is the market telling the company they need to cut the dividend, as good as the dividend grower risk-adjusted returns is, dividend cutters are the absolute worst. So we want to avoid companies that are potentially at risk of cutting their dividend. because that is that's not a good situation to be in. Additionally, what I would say is that, you know, again, you know, there's a difference between yield and income. We focus a lot when we try to explain to our clients, you know, the focus there should really be yield on cost, right? So, yeah, okay, so you buy a $100 stock, it's got a dollar dividend, you know, maybe that dollar dividend is, you know, that's a 1% yield. So you may not feel great about that. But if they increase that dividend to $5 over a number of years, that's a 5% yield on your initial cost of $100. And you probably got some price appreciation, you got a better company. And so your income stream has gone up. You probably had some good risk-adjusted returns in the underlying stock, and you're in a better situation if you're a conservative investor that's looking for a quality company.
Yeah, dividend growth certainly can be a great indicator of high-quality businesses. And certainly, you know, the example you gave of a company went from a dollar dividend to $5 a dividend. Not only did you get a really strong yield on cost, but also probably had a lot of appreciation because that was probably a company that was generating high quality earnings. So maybe you could talk a little bit about some examples of stocks that align with some of those concepts.
Sure. Yeah. I'll give a few examples. I mean, a very simple, obvious example would probably just be Walmart, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the biggest retailers in the world, huge footprint, great balance sheet. The type of company that in this environment probably comes out on top, the ability to take market share in a downturn, the ability to offer value to customers, particularly in an environment where prices are going higher. Company that can make investments in infrastructure, company can make investments in online, just a lot of financial firepower and consistency and a long-term track record that that's going to allow you to have both, again, have both, you know, current income and a management team and an opportunity to grow their business through many, many market cycles, right? That's sort of a obvious and clear example. A less obvious example I'll point to is a company that we've owned for a number of years, Parker Hannifin, historically a short cycle industrial company. They made a pretty good acquisition a few years ago to diversify their business into aerospace. Their business is about 30% aerospace. So the beauty here is that you had a company that was trading at an attractive valuation relative to some other peers. They made a very good acquisition, took on some debt to do it, diversified their business into a higher margin, different cycle in terms of the aerospace cycle, which is not aligned with sort of the short cycle industrial cycle. So it took some of the cyclicality out of the business. They've been able to generate strong returns, continue to increase the dividend, still trades at an attractive multiple relative to peers, when you can argue that they should probably trade at a higher multiple given the consistency of the business. So those are sort of two quick examples of companies that I would talk. One quite obvious, the other one maybe less so.
All right, great. So good stuff. And with that, I think we can wrap things up. And I think I'll just say thank you, Darnell, for joining the podcast today. Some really interesting insights during what is a very volatile time in the market today, but some really important insights for equity investors around quality investing and giving some great examples of you know, kind of maybe some higher ground right now. But definitely look forward to having you back again.
Thank you, Brian. Happy to be here.
Thanks, Darnell. And for listeners wanting to learn more about Lord Abbett's views on the markets, please visit the Insights section of lordabbett.com. We actually have a number of papers that the team has written on value and dividend investing that touches on a lot of what we discussed here today. And lastly, we'd also like to hear from our listeners. If you have any comments about today's podcast or ideas for future podcasts, we welcome your thoughts. Just email podcasts@lordabbett.com. So we'll leave it there. This has been Brian Forster with the Active Investor Podcast, and thank you for listening.
This podcast is intended solely for informational purposes and is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation. The contents are based on available information at creation and subject to change. It is not intended as investment, legal, or tax advice. Lord Abbett is not acting as your fiduciary. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments involve risk, including the loss of capital. Certain information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources, and such information has not been independently verified by Lord Abbett. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbot Speaker are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. References to specific asset classes and financial markets are for illustrative purposes only. Neither Lord Abbot nor the Lord Abbot Speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The information in this podcast does not constitute an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction. This broadcast is the copyright 2025 of Lord Abbot & Co. LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or any form without the permission of Lord Abbot. Lord Abbot Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbot Distributor LLC. For additional information on risk and a glossary of terms used in this broadcast, visit lordabbot.com. This episode was recorded on April 9th, 2025.